Hello, I'm Father Mitch Pacwa. Welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. Our guest tonight is a prolific author and the editor of the online women's magazine called Theology of Home. And she's here tonight to discuss how feminism is slowly capturing the psyche of Western women and men. We see that even among some Christians, feminism is viewed as opening up true equality and freedom for women. But our guest is seeking to expose this misconception and its deeply anti-Christian origins. She's the author of a brand new book called Something Wicked: Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. Please welcome my guest, Dr. Carrie Gress.
Hi, Father. Thanks
so much. It's good to have you back. It's been some time.
It has. It's great to be back.
For all the writing you're doing, we just don't have you back enough. We need to have you on more often.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
It's good. This is a tough subject from this point of view. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's so politically correct nowadays, is it?
It's not politically correct, but you know what's really interesting is it's a lot more politically correct than it was when I wrote my first book. I wrote my first book on feminism in 2017, The Anti-Mary Exposed, and really nobody was talking about feminism in a negative way at that point. And now, actually, it's really become something. People are really paying attention to it. I think people feel free to talk about it. I think before it felt very taboo, like, you can't criticize this. It's just about helping women. You know, if you criticize it, you're hurting women and all of that. But I think people have realized, like, it's got some deep problems and we need to expose them.
What do you think is making that change to put this topic on the shelf for actual discussion? What's happened?
Well, I think a number of things. I think people are really seeing the just the brokenness among women. You've got, you know, all the metrics are showing that women are less happy than they used to be. We've got all kinds of mental illness, depression, suicide, those kinds of things. But we're also seeing it in the second and third generations. You know, we're seeing this among children who are not attached properly to their mothers. And I think, too, people are getting tired of it. You see it especially among young men. I think this is behind the you know, part of the reason why a lot of young men are coming back to the church, coming back to traditions. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, we don't want women like what feminist women are striving for. We want women who are going to be wives and mothers, and you know, as unpolitically correct as that is, that's really what I think that people are looking for. And I think a lot of young women too are saying, you know, this hasn't worked well for my mother, my grandmother. Let's try something different that's going to be, you know, get back to the heart of the family, get back to the faith, and more traditional understanding of what it means to be male and female.
Well, I think something that captured a certain amount of the dysfunction taking place. I recall how last spring one of the governors was saying at a political rally, we don't need the men's vote, we women can just do it ourselves. You say, you know, guys are saying, okay, if you don't need us, you're on your own. And they're pulling away from, you know, contact with that kind of ideology that becomes exclusive. That the idea of, I recall back in the 60s, is including women in the economy, the society, business, politics. Inclusion was the goal. Now, they've come full circle.
Full
now
circle.
They want to exclude at least that one person was rhetorically saying we exclude men. Given that situation, it makes sense as you're talking why we can bring up critiques.
I think you're right. That individual who's saying, you know, we don't need men, this has been kind of baked into the cake for about 200 years. So it's really interesting. You go back to the, like, what's the basic anthropological understanding of male and female.
Well, first of all, when you say anthropological, are you talking about excavating the bones of Neanderthal people?
That's archaeology.
Oh, okay. What do you mean by anthropology?
Anthropology is the study of the human person. And what is it that you mean by the human person? So as Catholics, we believe in Genesis, you know, God created them, we're created in the image and likeness of God, we're meant to be fruitful and multiply and to serve one another. You know, that's kind of the biblical understanding that the West worked with for forever. And then you get to feminism, which, you know, as early as around the 1790s, they come up with this new idea, and it's very subtle. And when I say it, you're going to think it's like a punchline because it sounds so ridiculous. But basically what it is men are contemptible, so that's, you know, smash the patriarchy, that kind of idea, and that women need to be just like them is the way that's the relationship. So men are contemptible, women need to be just like them. That's the bedrock of what feminism is in terms of its anthropological.
Were they actually writing that?
Well, that's the amazing thing. If you look at Mary Wollstonecraft, she has nothing. She was deeply involved with this group of radical men who were very interested in the French Revolution. So they want egalitarianism. They want to get rid of the church. They want to get rid of any kind of hierarchy, like the military. They also want to get rid of any kind of relationship with a priest, a pastor. And Wollstonecraft herself ended up becoming a Unitarian, which means, of course, that she didn't believe in the person of Christ. So she actually thought that men were going to be an obstacle, including Jesus, to a relationship with God. And she had this understanding of God in a very rationalistic terms, you know, something to be reasoned to. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's kind of the bedrock. And then you just sort of see it unfold. So this example of this woman that you just gave that says we don't need men, well, that's the fullness of the idea. She's absolutely in the tradition. And you know, women have been told that we don't need men, we don't need children, we don't need our fertility. You know, all of those things are going to work against our happiness instead of, you know, leading us to a genuine kind of happiness.
Well, but do you think, and this is one of the things you were saying a second ago, this is trying to get rid of all the blocks to their happiness, but the statistics are showing that women are less happy than they were 60, 70 years ago.
Yeah.
And from what I've also read a little bit on, is even their life expectancy is starting to decline a little bit.
Yeah.
It's going down a little.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you look at certainly mental health, the anxiety and depression, the number of women who are on antidepressants has skyrocketed. Suicide numbers, substance abuse, drug abuse, even data around divorce, all of these kinds of things really point to women being incredibly unhappy. And you know, the real tragedy too is that I think there's kind of this bait and switch that happens with women. So when you're a young woman, you have, you know, all this ambition and this excitement about the world, and everyone tells you to go out and, you know, live your dreams and get your dream job and put your family on hold. And the sad reality is that there's so many women that bought into that, and then they get to this point where they're, you know, 50, 60, 70 years old, and they don't have a family. They don't have the relationships that they wanted because those were really sacrificed. And, you know, this is being perpetuated as well because even places like law schools or law firms are offering women the capacity to freeze their eggs so that then they can, you know, put off having a family until it's more convenient to them. Also not telling them that, of course, your fertility really takes a nosedive after 30 or 35. So it's
engine. Not only your fertility takes a nosedive, but your ability to keep up with a little rugrat.
Rugrats.
You know, that these little kids take a lot of energy.
A lot of energy.
This is for young men and women to chase little babies around.
Yes, as someone who had a child at 46, I can tell you it gets much harder the older you get. But in any event, so I think that's the real tragedy, is that we've been sold this idea that feminism is really just about equality, it's just about employment or education. And we've deeply bought into that narrative. And, you know, and of course, all the pieces of the narrative, if you go back and look at them, you know, were women really not educated? Well, if you look at what was happening in the church, Absolutely, women were being educated. Who was educating them? It was all the nuns. St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, you've got the Ursulines, you've got
Sister
Catherine
Ida,
Drexel.
Sister Danielle, yeah. Sister Cordelia. They were my teachers.
Yeah.
You know, I still say we had 45 to 55 kids in a class and one nun. And we kids were totally outnumbered by the nuns.
Isn't that amazing?
It really was amazing.
Yeah.
It really was.
No, it doesn't happen today. So I think that's the great thing is we have something remarkable to rediscover and to dust off and to see again. And I think that's what people are hungry for. They don't realize that's what they're hungry for. But they want those rich relationships. They want what family provides. They want what the faith provides.
Well, there's something else that has hit me over the years, mm-hmm. that a couple things are going on. One, that's the most basic. Folks who are in favor, what we would call the progressive mm-hmm. left and such, who would be in favor of feminism very strongly, mm-hmm. are finding themselves totally unable or, what I think, totally scared, witless about defining what a woman is, to be able to say what a woman is.
Yeah.
You get as high as the Supreme Court and you can't define a woman.
Yeah.
Though you might be a mother, a very successful professional, mm-hmm. highly educated, mm-hmm. Wonderfully.
Yeah.
And secondly, as a corollary to the inability to define a woman, mm-hmm. is they're using these very functional ways of talking about women. Oh, my neighbor with a uterus.
What is that, right? What is that?
I have an idea of uterus. I know I've seen them.
And you don't have one, so
no,
you have
I
that.
Don't have one, but I certainly have seen them.
Right.
When I'm taking animals apart, I see those.
Right.
That's all there. But I never define even a doe as an animal with a uterus. It's a doe.
Right.
But this is part of mm-hmm. the problem.
Yeah.
They've pushed themselves to a place where they become silent. They're
right.
incapable
right.
of defining woman.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that has to do with the second part of the anthropology. Men are contemptible, but women need to become just like them. And so the goal has been, how can we make ourselves more like men? And it's been going on for so long that I don't think anybody really thinks about it. But you know your Aristotle well. What we've done is we've made women sort of deformed males because they're aspiring to something that they can actually never achieve. And part of that is eliminating or controlling our own fertility. And what they're missing, and what obviously makes a good definition of understanding woman, is the notion of motherhood, and that's fundamentally what they reject, is they don't want to be defined by motherhood. And so if you look at media, if you look at television shows, movies, it's incredibly hard to find a mother figure who is favorable. I think of like Ma on Little House on the Prairie, that's kind of it. There's not, usually it's a mom who's, she's doing too much at once, or she's, mommy dearest, or, there's really, she's codependent, or Stepford Wives, all of these kinds of really awful characterizations of motherhood. And yet, what does everybody need and love? They love being mothered by a woman who really cares for them and isn't trying to control them, but wants to bring them to their, their best potential and their, mm-hmm. and gift them with her wisdom and whatnot. This is the beauty again of the church. You think of someone like Mother Angelica, because motherhood isn't just biological, it's also spiritual. So I think this is really what we have to offer, is this incredible witness of the saints, but also what motherhood really is. And I think people are craving that. They can't really put their finger on it, but again, because feminists have painted themselves into this corner of this sterile and functional understanding of womanhood, they never can really get to what womanhood is, because they've essentially lopped those parts off, both you know, on a functional level, but now even with the trans movement, that's, you know, as far as they've gone. So feminism is basically taken from women, the home, our husbands, our children, and now with the trans movement, it's coming after our very bodies. Mm-hmm. So it's been very effective in terms of convincing women that this is, you know, being like a man is going to make you happy.
Yeah, that's, in some ways, I've never seen the trans movement in terms of fulfilling that earliest level of feminism. Mm. Of, you know, men are contemptible and we have to be like them, and that they're moved to the point of, you know, removing even the aspects of their femininity, especially the reproduction. Mm-hmm. And some of their looks, and yet they still cannot change their DNA.
Yeah.
They can never change, mm-hmm, that every cell in their bodies is still X, Y, X.
Yeah.
They can't change that.
Right.
And it becomes self-destructive, mm-hmm, as they pump the wrong hormones.
Absolutely.
To sustain this distortion in their own natural structure, their own chromosome, their, mm-hmm, their cells, I should say, their own cells are harmed, mm-hmm, by getting this. It's, mm-hmm, it's a self-destructive quality that seems, yeah, to be inherent.
Yeah, and it's gonna be interesting too. I mean, this is the real tragedy, is obviously the trans movement is new enough that we haven't seen what happens 30, 40, 50 years out, but essentially it is a deep sterilization and a deep, you know, it's this deformed male. You will never truly be a male, as no matter what you desire, no matter how many people affirm you around you. It's just that, like you said, on that cellular level or even on that structural level, you know, when you die, your bones will still, people will be able to tell by your hips that you were a woman. So yeah, it's incredibly sad, and it, you know, it's very much wrapped up in this lost sense of identity, which is, I think we would not have gone to that space if it weren't for feminism. Feminism absolutely brought us to the trans movement.
I would say this, we actually do have the longitudinal studies in Europe.
Oh, wow.
Because the first
started
transition
sooner.
Started in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So they do have that. And I would urge my audience, you know, and your readers to check people like Dr. Quentin Van Mater, a pediatric endocrinologist who studies the endocrine system, mm-hmm, and he's got that long-term,
wow,
research, and it cuts life expectancy by 50%.
Wow, that's not surprising. Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, lots of other very serious effects.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's something else.
Yes,
but it's worth keeping in mind. That's why they don't do this with children anymore in Europe. It's,
yeah,
against the law, because they have the longitudinal studies.
Which is fascinating, because of all the issues that are happening in Europe, that is one that is not a problem. So that's great to hear that mm-hmm, actually the science really prevailed in Europe. That's great to hear.
The problem is that here, this research is not allowed to be published.
Wow.
Even in the academic journals.
Wow.
Because, again, what this feminism, mm-hmm, that you're describing leads to a closing of the mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if we had this trajectory that men are content that we have to become like them,
mm-hmm,
or become them,
yeah,
and that blinds them, willfully blinds, mm-hmm, to the evidence, mm-hmm, of the science, mm-hmm, and they can't incorporate that, so, mm-hmm, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, it's
right. Well, and the blindness gets deeper, of course, because of the sins connected to it, because promiscuity is one of the pieces, one of the parts of feminism, that, you know, women need to be sexually active as men are, the bad men, really. That's one of what they think the benefits are, or is, one of the benefits are. But in addition to that, that's really where we get abortion. You know, feminism is the engine for abortion, and I think that we need to be mindful of how, until we really grapple with feminism and understand what it is and where it's coming from, we're never going to get rid of abortion, because we, you know, so many of us, I know I was among them, thought, okay, once Roe's gone, things are going to get much better. And mm-hmm. yeah, here we are, things have gotten worse, largely because we neglected the culture. And feminism really has a grasp on the culture, and that's why we're having such a battle with it, because we haven't helped people understand just how incredibly negative it is, but also how it has to be there for the feminist vision, because that's how women have careers. This is how they fulfill themselves. This is how they compete with men, is by having that backstop of abortion that is the complement to the promoted promiscuity.
And I sensed, you know, Roe v. Wade just changed a decision, you know, getting rid of it, mm-hmm. changed a decision by the Supreme Court to undo the legislation mm-hmm. of the states, mm-hmm. and on a false basis of a non-existent right in the Constitution. It just doesn't exist mm-hmm. there. But it puts back to the states, and to the people in the states, mm-hmm. this, and the decision-making and legislation. And when in the 60s and 70s, abortion legislation was rejected in all the states except New York and California. Mm. Now that Christian background that mm-hmm. existed in mm-hmm. people's minds is no longer even supported by many of the Christian churches.
Yeah, no, it's all gone.
Mm-hmm. You know, the mainline Protestant churches mm-hmm. had gone pro-choice, mm-hmm. and even the evangelicals had been pro-choice by 1958.
Wow.
And they later on repented of that
right.
and changed. Mm-hmm. But the mainline churches never did, mm-hmm. and it's destroyed them. I mean, they're non-factors
right.
For the most part. They're dying out.
Yeah.
But the culture is also harmed by this.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. Deeply harmed by this. And people are waking up to it, I think, largely because they're paying attention to the birth dearth. That is something that it's been remarkable to see. That's gotten people thinking about, well, how do we get couples to get married again? How do we solve this mm-hmm. problem? What can we do as financial incentives? What can we do as political incentives? But I think it's not going to change until we change the cultural incentives, until we help women understand that there's something incredible about marriage. There's something incredible about being a mother, about being a mom, about this idea of helping bring the best out of people. And I think this is one of the true evils that feminism has brought about, is this idea of toxic empathy. I think that's kind of the language, or this misplaced compassion.
Yeah, what do you mean by toxic empathy? I thought empathy was a good thing.
It's not always a good thing. So one of the things that feminism has done is it's given women this idea that they can save the world. And I actually found this one point in history. It was actually a Jungian psychiatrist, Esther Harding, whom you might be familiar with, but she's writing about this, how she had this patient come to her. I want to say it was like the 1920s or 30s. And this patient says, well, I really want to go change the world. And Esther Harding is writing and saying, this is the most ridiculous idea I've ever heard anybody say. Well, of course, now look at all of our literature, on college campuses or jobs or, you know, job fairs. It's all about how do you change the world. And I think that this is a
even
deep
on
desire.
Commercials.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
tagline on commercials for everything. This will change your world. This is a game changer.
Yeah.
No, it cleans fruit. It gets rid of wrinkles. It's not going to change my world.
Right.
It's just cleaning the fruit.
Exactly. So that's the big shift that happened, was, but all of it is in a way that's remote. So if you see a lot of the things that drive young women, it's this idea of how do I help the people in Africa or the people I will never meet, instead of this understanding of loving locally. How do we love the people around us? And this is really where motherhood and women are at their best, is when they understand that you can change your husband, your family, your children, the people around you, your community, your parish. You know, that when we love locally, because we're so embodied and because, you know, we're made in that very embodied way where, our, you know, touch is important, seeing is important, a hug is important, all of those elements, that's what's been lost. And so instead we've been offered this, you know, sort of abstraction but there's no sacrifice involved in that because you're not actually dealing with people on a regular basis. So that, and I think that's really where the empathy has become twisted and made something really dangerous. And instead of really understanding that if you're going to love people, you have to love the people around you first. That's where you start. And then, of course, when you do that well, that's when God gives you bigger things. And we see that certainly in the lives of the saints.
Some years ago, there was a book called Ungodly Rage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Remember that?
Yeah.
And it also quoted a number of the leaders and founders mm-hmm. of the Women's Ordination Conference. These were mm-hmm. women who were pushing for the ordination of women.
Yeah.
And they were saying, we want to get into the priesthood so that we can change the church.
Mm-hmm.
Similar mentality,
yeah.
Changing the world, to change the church and destroy all priesthood and patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
This was not implied. They stated this mm-hmm. at their meetings,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and this lady just happened to be there
yeah.
when they said it.
Well, what's amazing is that they weren't the first ones to say that. In fact, I found back in the 1800s, you know, the first wave that everybody thinks was the good wave, and then feminism was sort of sidetracked or subverted. You find even among Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony mm-hmm. saying, feminism, we need feminism because men have used Christianity to enslave women, and we have to get rid of mm-hmm. Christianity. That mm-hmm. that was one of the goals from the very beginning.
Yes.
So that was there. So this is, again, the fruit of that. But I have to say, on a bright note, I read that book about 10 years ago, Ungodly Rage. I read
yes.
it again and thinking, okay, what's going to be in here that I can use in my research? And it's all gone. It's all gone. None of that is relevant anymore. It was so satisfying because I read it in the 90s and it was still
yes.
an issue. And now it's absolutely, there are other issues, but that's not one that we're facing as the
that's
church
right.
anymore.
That's right. It's, is a change. And, you know, in one sense, because that is no longer, you know, and the issue at once was, I think there are a few people here or there
right.
pushing.
But no one's listening.
yeah. But one of the things is that can give us hope that these destructive qualities of feminism that, again, looks at men as contemptible
mm-hmm.
and we have to be like them. You know,
mm-hmm.
to have a movement based on becoming what you hate is very odd to my little brain.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm missing
no,
something.
No, you're not. It's very odd. It's very odd.
But trying to become what you hate,
yeah.
You know, oftentimes is, well, it's just inherently self-destructive.
But this is, I think, one of the important things that I discovered in my research is how much feminism has promoted this idea of anger and rage. I found, going back to the 1890s, that the socialists realized that if they made women angry, they were going to be a lot more politically expedient than if women were peacefuler and happy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where consciousness raising came from. It came from, you know, New York State, Podunk area, socialists promoted it. And it went all the way around the world. And so, you know, when Kate Millett and Angela Davis and all these other radicals in the 1970s are promoting consciousness raising, They don't realize this is a very American socialist idea. They, you know, make it some exotic idea from Mao's China, I think is how they promoted it. But if you look at it, you know, we the church has the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. And feminism has mimicked that, but in its inversion. So it's rage, despair, or rage, anger, and contempt. Those elements are all at play. So if you look at any women's march, you know, these kinds of public events, there's not a lot of faith, hope, and love going on at those events. You know, there's always an incredible amount of anger and contempt towards men and towards, you know, women that they don't agree with, and on and on. And that, you know, none of that has changed. It's all been incredibly intentional so that women continue to be angry about something. And this is why, even if you look at feminism, you know, in the 90s, when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was elevated to the Supreme Court, she went back to try to find, you know, where were the areas in which women still weren't equal, and she couldn't find any. So it was at this stage where she said, well, let's get rid of Mother's Day and just make it Parents' Day. And, you know, she's asking for these elimination of gender altogether. But that this is, you know, part of it is that feminism always has to find something new to be angry about. And that's, it kind of rebrands itself. And this is how you continue to get women to buy into it, is through that anger.
This is a very important thought. We have to take a break right now. I want to come back to some of this. I urge you that if you want to find out more about Dr. Gress and her work, you can go to carriegress.com, carriegress.com. And you can also check out her magazine, Theology of Home. It's an online magazine at theologyofhome.substack.com. Theologyofhome.substack.com. We'll be back in just a moment, so please stay with us and we'll continue on with this discussion. Welcome back. We are discussing a brand new book called Something Wicked: Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity. It's by our guest, Dr. Carrie Gress. And you can get it at EWTNRC.com. It is item number 15588. 15588. And it's an important discussion given the way things are going. Something I want to get back to that I brought up in our first segment, namely, I've been amazed at how a number of people on the progressive feminist side are unable, I doubt it. I don't believe that they're unable to define womanhood. I think they are afraid to define womanhood because the destruction of femininity by feminism is so thorough, any definition they give will be pounced upon by someone who says, no, that's not it! and these are already fairly angry people.
Yeah.
You know, that this is...
Very.
Not only angry, I would say humorless. They, just saying this is a little side point, I have a quick rule of thumb that crazy people can't laugh at themselves. And people who can't laugh at themselves might really be crazy. Its corollary. But be that as it may, that's a sidebar.
And
what they've done is they've made this move towards defining my neighbor with a uterus or some other, you know, physical thing that's part of their body. You know, then they go on. Because they're making it up. They can't even agree on that. So they use different body parts to define their neighbor. What would you say about defining a woman? What is it that makes a woman woman? I mean, not just that she has double X chromosomes, you know, DNA.
Just an adult female, right? I think this is a great question, and one, again, that the church is uniquely qualified to answer. First of all, because we're not trying to make men into women. We understand that there's male and female.
Nor women into men.
Exactly. And so we don't have that problem of trying to categorize things that are uncategorizable. But I think that the reality is the definition of motherhood, of womanhood has to include motherhood. And that's been wildly unpopular. And I think one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to talk about as a culture, because we haven't said anything good about woman or motherhood in decades. But this is where you really see the church. What is Holy Mother Church? She's a woman. Even the language that we use for the church, in the Romance languages, it's female. You have the nave of the church, that's named after navy, after ships. That's feminine language. This is why ships are always named after women. It's it's things, elements that carry things, that transform things. An oven is feminine. Even the word a casket, a river of water. All of these things are feminine because they recognize the capacity that women have to give life, to give birth, to transform.
And to bear.
And to bear and to hold, exactly, all of that. And I think that this is one of the things that's, just exciting when you think about understanding the church and what the church does. Why do we call the church Holy Mother Church? That there's something intuitively good and beautiful and compelling about that. And so contextualizing it that way, I think, helps people really understand more of what it means to be mother instead of just this codependent woman that, the Stepford wives and the things that we've been told by the culture that, women are just, they're doormats and they can't think for themselves. If you're a wife, we've been given this kind of dichotomy, like it's either that kind of doormat woman or you've got a savvy feminist, but you don't have anything kind of in the middle that's actually healthy and ordered and, that breaks those two oppositions up and meets with reality. So we can find that. And I think, one of the people that did this really well in terms of understanding woman was with St. Edith Stein, when she talks about, the world doesn't need what women have, but who women are. And just that capacity that we have, no matter where we are, if we're in our home, if we're in the workplace, we have the capacity to make life around us better. We also have the capacity to make it a lot worse. But when you're around...
That sounds basically human.
It is. It's very human. But when you're around a woman who understands what it means to be a woman and that it's really her responsibility to love others through a sacrificial kind of love, then I think that's really where you find incredible fruit in relationships, in workplaces that where things are ordered and go well. We really have people understanding that they're loved and cared for and seen in very important and vital ways.
This gets at a basic human issue that even some of the secular folks are beginning to realize, that if you have your life centered on accomplishing self-oriented tasks, and that you end up using other people, for your own tasks, to get them to do what you want, instead of looking out, how can I be at the loving service of the people around us? If you make it all about yourself, Mm-hmm. We tend to call that clinical narcissism,
right.
Which is a psychological disorder that is a pandemic mm-hmm. throughout our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And tragically, psychologists point out, it's very difficult for narcissists mm-hmm. to get a cure because they don't realize how bad off they are mm-hmm. till they're in their 60s or 70s mm-hmm. and they finally realize, you mean the whole world isn't centered on me?
Right.
That's
yeah.
Right. But the other thing is it makes people depressed, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people who orient themselves toward self-giving
mm-hmm. yeah.
and toward others, men and women alike, mm-hmm. oriented toward, they're the ones who are at peace.
Yeah.
They're the ones
find themselves.
Who find right. that they're not depressed, but we call it happiness.
Yeah, imagine that, right? You know, I think that's a really key point. And one of the things that gets lost in the conversation about what feminism is that fundamentally it's about power and control. And this is really what the movement has been trying to do, is to get whatever it is that women want, that the elite women think that women ought to want, rather than, like you said, going back to what is it that really makes us happy? And it is self-sacrifice, it's delayed gratification, it's self gift and just how important these things are for our own maturation. You know, you can't actually mature. You can't get out of, I think, this adolescent phase if you're constantly thinking that everything is there to serve you. And yet the sad realities, and I'm sure you've seen the data on what's happened, where the narcissist and the cluster Bs come from, a lot of it is attachment disorders, where these individuals did not have the right kind of attachment with usually a mother or primary caregiver between the ages of 0 and 3. Mm-hmm. And that's really, that deficit is what they're always trying to make up for. And, mm-hmm. you know, like you said, it's incredibly difficult to know how to help them because on a lot of ways they, you know, especially among women, they appear to be very high functioning and very motivated and, you know, amiable and, you know,
and sometimes very powerful,
incredibly powerful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, there's this drive for self and manipulation and, you know, all the negatives that come with that.
And, you know, that attachment is best when it's attachment to their mother and father. We
mm-hmm.
we went through that
hugely
phase
yeah.
of child rearing
yeah.
where the battle cry was quality time, yeah. not amount of time.
Right.
I don't think that's the way it works with small yeah. children.
Yeah, no, undoubtedly.
They need a lot of time,
right?
And the attachment is constant. As I mm-hmm. just said in my sermon not too many weeks ago, how many of you parents told your children something once and they immediately did what you said?
Right.
Does that happen in your house?
Never.
No.
Never.
No.
Exactly. So no,
it's constant presence.
Right. It's that, but it's also that this checking in that happens. I noticed this when I paid attention to it in my third child, I noticed that he would go off and play for a while, and then he would always just come back and check in just to make sure I was there and sort of touch me, see me, make a connection, and then he would go off and do something else again. And I think that's another important piece of it, is it's mm-hmm. sort of that feeling comfortable that mom is still always there. That's a vital piece. But I think you bring up something even more important, which is the role of the father. And that was one of the things that I had. It was really fun to research this because it's no one talks about this, just how important the father is in the culture and in raising children. And one of the thinkers that I found from the 70s actually talked about the problem with when you only have mothers running the family is you always end up sort of ghettoizing everyone, because what happens with the children is, you know, the mother just wants the children close by, but it's the father who brings the sense of, okay, you need to go out into the world now, or you have a gift that you need to protect. He's sort of like this hydraulic dam, was the analogy was made, he's the one that says, you gotta be pushed out of the nest, or you need to strengthen this or protect that. And that's really where you have the full embodiment of culture, and you can kind of move beyond the ghetto,
exactly.
is that incredible gift that men have to bring to their family.
To me, it's encapsulated the way, you know, when they're born, babies' ability to see is actually the distance from its mother's breast to her eyes. Mm. That's as far as they can see.
Yeah, yeah.
And you almost think they're made for that.
Like, imagine, right?
Yeah, and the idea of moms holding their children, talking to them, and doing all this, whereas a dad's instinct, nobody tells us guys to do this, but we do. We take our babies and throw them in the air and catch them, driving the mothers crazy.
It is. It's so painful, but yeah, it's so important, though.
In one sense, that encapsulates how a mother teaches a child security and enveloping love.
Yeah.
And a dad teaches them risk. Mm-hmm. I'll toss you in the air, and I'll probably catch you.
I hope I'll catch you. Yeah.
But isn't that the case?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It really is that balance has to be there for the healthy maturing
and
of the child.
That very, you know, dads wrestle with their kids on the floor. Moms talk and, you know, hang around the kitchen cutting and, you know.
Right.
It's two very different functions that accomplish this wholeness of a person.
Mm-hmm. Right, both those sides then are developed. So, yeah, I think that's a key piece that we have to start talking about more and doing more research and really understanding that aspect of what men are bringing to the table, because we know it's rich and important, but it's been hard to talk about because
it's impossible because they're afraid to find the answer what men actually do to accomplish, with the raising of their child. They're afraid of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I think that's changing now. I think people are open to the conversation. The conversations are actually happening now. You could actually get, you know, books published on this kind of content again.
Wow.
So it's very heartening. There's certainly some good with the bad, or some bad with the good, but you know, the idea of the gifts that men have in the culture is really coming back.
Yeah, I think that's an important aspect. Just some of the research that shows when dad helps with the homework, the kids get A's and B's.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen when mom, and it's the same answers.
Right, right.
It has nothing to do with the right answers. It's something about the relationship that changes their attitude towards school.
Right, just how important it is. And then,
same
of course,
thing with going to church.
I was going to say the spiritual element is really vital too. I think that's another thing, and instead of just it being something that mom does, that everybody just sort of goes along with. We've got to get back to the sense of really understanding, you know, what is the patriarchy? Like, this is that big question. We've been, you know, treated it so terribly, and yet here it is. It's the church hierarchy. It's these gifts that men have. Christ is at the top of the patriarchy, of the hierarchy. And really understanding that role that men have as a leader spiritually, and not just financially otherwise.
That's
but
right.
This is all these pieces have to go together.
Yeah, that would truncate. If all that a guy does is bring home a paycheck, it truncates his manhood.
Yeah.
The way that seeing that, you know, all mom does is cook meals would truncate her femininity.
Yeah.
There are other things that are part of this whole complex of living together and being a family.
And I think that's really the key, is that understanding of men and women working together as a team, instead of this combative nature, which, of course, feminism can only sow because of the fact that it's built on envy. You can never get to a healthy relationship when one of the couple envies the other and wants to be like the other or control the other. You're never going to build on that, and that's what we've been trying to work with, and we've got to get back to this idea of what's good for the couple and then what's good for the family, that notion of the common good.
Yeah, I've said many, many times on these programs that when parents are not married to each other, that's the surest indicator that the children will be poor, they will not finish high school,
right?
They will become children out of wedlock, and they'll be in prison. Number one indicator.
Yeah.
Whereas the cohesive family, And it is, in the case, the opposite.
Yeah, and we have the hard data on that. That's not just you,
it's not
you being
my
a
feeling.
Great priest, exactly.
No, no.
Yeah, no, it's, the data is very clear and explicit on that now.
But the other side of that is, as men and women mm-hmm. interact, raising a family, being mother and father, mm-hmm. they mature themselves. This
yeah.
is when they come into their own.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I like what you say. You know, you can't isolate motherhood
yeah.
from being woman, and you mm-hmm. can't isolate fatherhood from being
right.
man.
Right. And
that's what makes us mature as adults.
It's true. And I think that that's really where, you know, so many women struggle and say, well, he doesn't lead, or I don't trust him. And this is where, when a man really understands how to pray and is focused on his relationship with God and trying to live according to the church teachings, that's the kind of man a woman will follow. And it's much easier to follow that man rather than the man that doesn't know himself, doesn't know his faith, sort of operating off of spiritual fumes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something important for men to understand, is that that's an incredibly attractive trait, is that capacity to know God and have a direction. And then a woman will say, I want to go in that direction with you, instead of her dictating the direction, which is what happens so often. If he's got a direction figured out, then it's much easier for a woman to really want to follow that.
At the same time, and I hear, it's one of my favorite things to hear from men who have remained faithful and married to the same woman for 50, 60 years, when he says, if it weren't for her, I would have been dead.
Yeah, right.
You know, that yeah. I never would have made it through life without her.
Mm-hmm.
That there is that,
but it's that
mutuality.
Back and forth, right. Both are so important to the other, right.
And that to me is the death of feminism.
Mm-hmm.
That men and women appreciate the mutuality
yeah.
of each other's genius.
Mm-hmm.
John Paul always used to write about the female genius, and there's
yeah.
also the male genius.
Right.
The genii need to be together.
They absolutely have to work together, and one
yeah.
inspires the other. One thing I found out recently, you probably already knew this, though, is women have the capacity to reset men's nervous system. So a wife who's peaceful and ordered, like that, I mean, it kind of blew my mind actually when I heard that, because I just had never heard it before. But it makes a lot of sense, especially if you look at poetry, you look at music lyrics. What is it that men say they love about women? It's not she's frenetic and angry and bossy, you know, like it's something else. And
I didn't even write those songs, and I don't listen to a lot of them, but I know that.
Writes that. But it's that sense of home, of being cared for, of tenderness. You know, those are the skills, and that's what we're just not hearing about as young women. I think we're really taught to be afraid of those things, and this is why we need to get back to really understanding what women are, and what, you know, finding those role models among mm-hmm. the women that we know and
yeah.
among the couples that
and
we admire.
This doesn't mean, and we only have a minute left, but, you know, it doesn't mean that therefore a woman can never work. She
right.
just, no. Hey, motherhood is a lot of work.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
Right.
But also, you know, there are other aspects of job that come mm-hmm. and go in
right.
varying aspects, but there's this quality. I just want to make sure that we get people to check out some of your work. Just go to carriegress.com to find out more of your research and other great work, because you are a mom, but you're also working hard.
Right.
Also, you can check out her book, her online magazine, Theology of Home. It's an online magazine. Just go to theologyofhome.substack.com, theologyofhome.substack.com, and her book that we've been talking about, Something Wicked, Why Feminism Can't Be Fused with Christianity, by Carrie Gress. It's item number 15588, that's 15588, at EWTNRC.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is great.
And may the Lord bless all of you and keep you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And we can bring you Dr. Gress and all the other guests, plus all the other programs we have here, only because this network is brought to you by you. That's how Mother was inspired for this. So please keep us in between your gas bill, electric bill, and cable bill every month, and we'll be able to pay our bills every month. God bless you all and keep you.